Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Sink or Swim podcast. Today we'll be covering part two of the Ortho Basics podcast. It's Daniel Acevedo and I'll be your host again. In this episode, we'll be covering primarily the different fixation methods that are available in orthopedic surgery and what type of stability you'd be achieving with these methods. We'll talk about some of the different implants available, including the plates and screws that you can use. And we'll also cover a little bit about intramedullary nails. So before we jump right into implants, remember that there's two types of bone healing. There's primary bone healing and there's secondary bone healing, also known as direct and indirect bone healing. And remember that it's dependent on the amount of strain at the fracture site. Think of strain as how much the bone fragments are moving relative to each other at the fracture site. The less movement there is, the more likely you are to get direct healing. Most fractures are going to have some movement and not be stable. And that's why, naturally, if you don't treat these injuries operatively, you get indirect bone healing. So depending on the fracture pattern and depending on the type of bone healing that you are wanting to pursue, that'll determine the type of implants that you're going to use. Other factors that might influence the type of fixation that you use include age, whether the patient is skeletally mature or immature, how their patient's bone quality is. Does this patient have osteoporosis or metabolic bone disease? Again, the fracture pattern and location. And then also if there's any soft tissue injuries or other associated injuries. You want to assess if the soft tissues can handle the incision needed for internal fixation, as well as assess if there are any other injuries on the same limb that will also require fixation. All these factors collectively can be placed into three categories, which are patient factors, fracture characteristics, and then just other. And so for our discussion, we're going to start by talking about the implants that will give you the best chance of having absolute stability and therefore direct bone healing. And then we'll slowly, as we progress, work our way to the implants that give you relative stability and will therefore give you indirect bone healing. The first implant we're going to talk about is also one of the most basic ones, and it's a lag screw. And so what a lag screw does is that it'll compress both ends of a bone fragment together. This is called interfragmentary compression. There's two ways to go about lagging a fracture. You can do what's called lag by technique or lag by design. And so what those terms mean is that if you have a screw that is lag by design, the screw has been designed by the manufacturer to lag. And the way they do that is that the screw is only partially threaded, say about halfway up the screw. And so what happens is that the distal threads of the screw will pull the more distal bone fragment towards you. And when I say distal in this situation, I mean distal from you, not necessarily distal on the patient's body. It's a little bit hard to explain, and so for this you're definitely going to want to look up an image of a lag screw, and I think that'll really clear up any confusion that you might be feeling at this moment. There's a really cool picture by the AAO Foundation that will show you little motion arrows and really paint a clear picture of what's happening when you use a lag screw. The second option, the lag by technique, is employing the same basic concept, but you're using a normal, fully threaded screw. The way you do it is that you overdrill the near cortex to the size of the external diameter of the screw. And then this will be known as your gliding hole, because the screw is gliding through this hole. Then you will drill the far cortex to the appropriate size for the screw that you have. And then this way, the screw threads will only engage the far cortex and then result in compression along the fragment. One common pimp question when you're dealing with a lag screws is how do you want to place the lag screw in regards to the fracture? And the answer is that you want it to be perpendicular to the fracture. That way you're getting the most compression along that fracture site. This will make a lot more sense when you look at the image. Importantly, whether you lag by technique or whether you lag by design, in either situation, you're going to need to use what's called a neutralization plate. You're not just going to place one lag screw and call it a day. And the reason for this is that because when you use a lag screw, the compression that you're getting from that screw is only in one plane. Therefore, you need what's called a neutralization plate to help hold that fracture stable by protecting it from any torsional, rotational, or shearing forces. There is also an image by the AAL Foundation that does a good job showing how these forces act on the fracture site and how, if you don't use a neutralization plate, they will affect the fracture. So you're probably wondering at this point when you would want to use a lag screw, what fracture patterns are amenable to using a lag screw? And the two most common ones would be a spiral fracture and an oblique fracture. And this makes sense if you think back to earlier when I said that you have to place the screw perpendicular to the fracture line. Because obviously, if you had a transverse fracture, for example, perpendicular to the fracture line would be inside of the bone. And so that wouldn't really work. And so that actually brings up a good segue into our next topic, right? So, how would you get that interfragmentary compression that you want for direct bone healing on a transverse fracture? And the way you would do that is by using what's called a compression plate. With a compression plate, you would again place the plate perpendicular to the fracture, and you would ideally want the fracture line to be at the middle of the plate lengthwise. What's unique about compression plates is that they have these sort of oblong holes that, when you drill into them, you can drill eccentrically or concentrically. In order to create compression at the fracture site using a compression plate, you're going to place your first screw concentrically into the hole and then create an axilla along the bone and plate. Then, when you go to place your second screw, you are going to place it eccentrically. Each subsequent screw will also be placed eccentrically to further compress the fracture through the plate. The way this works is that as the screw begins to settle on the plate, because the hole is oblong, it will actually cause the plate to shift, pulling the two ends of the fracture together and subsequently causing compression at the fracture site. Same as before, a picture is worth a thousand words with this. And so definitely look up some pictures. The AO Foundation again has great pictures for this topic, and it really helps to clear up how these implants function. Before we continue talking about the different implants, there are some things you should know about screws. There are many different types of screws, and you're definitely not expected to know all of them. Even after all of your weight rotations, you still won't know all the types of screws that there are and how they function. But some basic ones that you should be familiar with include cortical screws and cancellous screws to start. Cortical screws are meant to, as the name implies, engage the cortex. Ideally, you would want a cortical screw to engage the neocortex and the far cortex. If you were planning on not engaging the far cortex, you could consider using a cancellous screw, which the main difference is it has a wider pitch. If you don't know, the pitch is the distance between the threads. Cancellous screws are meant to better engage your cancellous bone using their wider pitch. Next up, we have cannulated screws, which are screws that are basically hollow through the center. The reason you would have a cannulated screw is when you are placing the screw over a guide wire. Cannulated screws have some pros. They're faster to use and they're more precise because you just have to place them over the guide wire once you get your guide wire in the right spot. The drawbacks are that they're more expensive and they have what's known as a decreased pullout strength, meaning they will pull or back out of the bone with less force. Next up, we have locking screws, which, as the name implies, lock into the plate that you are screwing them through. These are typically used in cases where you have poor bone quality or you have concerns about the patient's bone quality. The actual physics behind them is a little confusing, and so I'm not going to try to explain it to you because I've read the article a handful of times and I still don't fully get it. But the AO Foundation, again, has articles detailing this that you can read up on. And then there's also headless screws. And so headless screws are basically just screws without a head. They're threaded the full way, and so they will bury themselves into the bone. Next, we're going to talk about bridge plates. But before that, I just want to touch on what's known as the principles of plate fixation. And so, while it might seem that there are a lot of quote unquote types of plates, the important thing for you to realize is that the type of plate is actually determined by how you, the surgeon, use it. A neutralization plate can act as a compression plate and can also act as a bridge plate, depending on how you are using it. Now, there are some situations where how the plates were machined, for example, whether they have locking holes, can actually augment or limit their use. But generally speaking, the type of plate is determined by you. With that being said, let's talk about bridge plating. This is actually where we are making our transition into relative stability. Bridge plates are designed to be used with indirect reduction, and they are often employed in areas where there is a lot of comminution. These plates will span that fracture without obtaining fixation in each individual fragment, essentially holding the two ends of the bone in place and allowing callus formation to hold the fragments together and eventually heal. Next up, we have anti-glide slash buttress plates. So these plates are a little similar, they're kind of like opposites. Buttress plates specifically are employed for partial articular metaphyseal fractures, while anti-glide plates are used for oblique diaphyseal fractures. They both have the same mechanism of action in that they neutralize shearing forces, i.e., prevent sliding or shortening during axial loading, and both of them are generally placed at what is known as the axilla of the fracture. Again, you're going to want to look up some reference pictures of these to kind of get a better understanding for what they look like and how to use them. And again, the AAO Foundation has tons of pictures that are great. Next, we have tension banding, which is a little unique compared to the previous implants we've talked about so far. Tension bands are interesting because they convert tensile distracting forces into compressive forces. And so generally these are used for transverse articular fractures like at your olecranon or your patella. And you can also use them for fractures at the base of tendon insertions or ligament insertions. Some examples would be your medial malleolus, your greater tuberosity, and your ulnar styloid. Last, but certainly not least, we have our intramedullary nails. I would be shocked if you did a orthopedic rotation and didn't see at least one nail be placed. There are many different types of intramedullary nails nowadays. There are nails for your humerus, your femur, your tibia, your fibula, your radius, your ulna, and there's probably more out there that I can't even think of. There are also many types of nails in regard to recon nails, cephalomedullary nails, but that is a little bit out of the scope of what's expected for a med student to know. It's much more important for you to know when you would want to use a nail, what the benefits of using a nail are, and how they work. So, intramedullary nails, similar to bridge plates, are also designed to be used with indirect reduction. You typically will insert them through very small incisions, and you most commonly will see them used for femur and tibia fractures, where a plate fixation would require an otherwise very extensive soft tissue dissection, or in areas where there is extensive comminution. An important thing you want to know about intramedullary nails is that they are what is known as a load-sharing device, which means that patients are generally allowed to bear weight immediately after surgery, the limiting factor typically being their pain. Now, this is a little dependent on fracture pattern, and very unstable fracture patterns. Some surgeons may prefer to still keep patients non-weight bearing for a period of time. Intramedullary nails owe their increasing popularity in recent years, partially due to the early weight bearing that they allow. Specifically in trochanteric fractures, before cephalomedullary nails began to be used, fixed angle devices like the sliding hip screw were regularly used. Now, a sliding hip screw or a dynamic hip screw can still be used for stable trochanteric fractures, but cephalomedullary nails have been shown to be tremendously more successful in treating unstable trochanteric fractures. A common PIMP question you'll get on your rotations are, what are the four characteristics of an unstable trochanteric fracture? Those four factors are posterior medial comminution, lateral wall insufficiency, reverse obliquity, and subtrochanteric extension. So, due to the fact that they had higher rates of success and did not have the strict post-op weight-bearing restrictions like the sliding hip screw, the popularity of cephalomedullary nails quickly took off. You might be asked about what some of the biomechanical advantages for cephalomedullary nails are. The first one is that there's an increased load-bearing capacity due to the more medial positioning of the intramedullary fixation, which provides a more efficient load transfer through the calcar compared to more lateral extramedullary cortical fixations like the sliding hip screw. Additionally, by sitting within the medullary canal, cephalomedullary nails reduce the distance between the implant and the hip joint, resulting in a shorter lever arm, which decreases the tensile strain on the implant, leading to a more biomechanically stable construct capable of early weight bearing. It's important to note that while there is a wide array of cephalomedullary nails available on the market, recent meta-analyses have not found any one nail to be superior. One last point about cephalomedullary nails before we move on is the difference between a long nail and a short nail. There is a lot of literature talking about the pros and cons to both. It's an area of current debate, and so you probably won't be asked many questions about it, but at the very least, you should know when it is appropriate to use a short nail and when it is not. So we've now covered a majority of the surgical treatment options. We should talk a bit about the absolute indications for surgery and some of the more relative indications for surgery. But before that, we still need to cover external fixation and casting slash splinting, which are two of the options which will give you the least stability. External fixation is a great option for when you have an injury that has extensive soft tissue swelling, and you want to give the patient some form of stability that is greater than a cast or splint can confer, but you don't necessarily want to do an open reduction internal fixation. You'll commonly see these be used in pilon fractures. In regards to swelling, the way to know if swelling has decreased enough to the point where you can take the patient in surgery is to check their skin for any creasing or wrinkling. So if the swelling has gone down to the point where you can wrinkle or crease their skin, then it's not too swollen. And then the opposite is also true. If the skin is so swollen that you can't wrinkle or crease the skin, then surgery is not really an option at that time. The reason swelling is such a concern for surgery is because it can significantly increase your risk of infection and other complications. When it comes to X fixes, you always want to make sure that the pin sites are being kept clean and well bandaged. And so, one of the things you can always do to be helpful to your residents is to check which patients have X fixes and ask them if they need any help doing the dressing changes for those. If you don't know how to do them, they're pretty straightforward. You can find videos online on how to do it. And then if your resident does allow you to do it, you want to make sure that you are getting a good look of the pin site and checking for any signs of infection and letting your resident know right away if there are any signs. Some residents might ask you to take pictures on their phone when you go to do it so that they can upload them into the chart and just kind of keep track of how they're progressing. Casts and splints we'll cover a little bit more in depth later in the podcast. So, regarding the absolute and relative indications for surgery, the absolute indications for orthopedic surgery include injuries where there is an open fracture, injuries where there is vascular injury that is compromising blood flow, and any nerve injuries that might be affecting sensation or movement. Compartment syndrome would also be an absolute indication for surgery. One last absolute indication would be if there's additional ipsilateral fractures which are resulting in a floating joint like an elbow or knee. These are all basically situations where delaying surgery could have serious consequences for the limb or the patient. Some of the relative indications for surgery include any polytrauma patients or patients with pathologic fractures. These are cases where the decision to operate is really based on careful consideration of the patient's overall health, the complexity of the fractures, and the potential risks and benefits of surgery. It's situations where there's not always a clear-cut benefit. Along with these absolute and relative indications, you're going to want to keep in the back of your mind the hard and soft signs of vascular injury that are associated with extremity trauma. Now, you probably learned these back when you were on your general surgery rotation, but it's probably been a while since then, so we're going to go over them here again. So, the hard signs are pulselessness, pallor, paresthesia, pain, paralysis, rapidly expanding hematoma, massive bleeding, palpable or audible bruit. And then the soft signs are history of bleeding in transit, proximity related injury, neurologic finding from a nerve adjacent to a named artery, and then hematoma over a named artery. Remember that depending on whether you have hard or soft signs and whether you are dealing with a direct or blunt injury can all influence your next step in management. And so it would be good to reference back to those flowcharts from your world in terms of what your next step should be when dealing with patients with potential vascular injuries. And so while there are a lot of different options for achieving fixation, the differences between them can boil down to one of two ways. Firstly, what amount of soft tissue disruption are you going to need to place this implant? And what I mean by that is, how big is the incision that you're going to have to make? Obviously, if you're going to use a long bridge plate, it's going to require a much larger incision than, say, a nail. And then the other main way that these implants will differ is by the amount of stability that they confer to the fracture and its environment. Now, at this point in the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about splinting and casting. Most places that you will rotate at will typically have you splinting fractures in the ED, but there are some places where casting is preferred. Either way, though, we'll take this opportunity to kind of cover some of the basic ways you can be useful when you are taking call on your away rotations, since this is typically where you will encounter the majority of the splinting you see. There are many different types of splints that you can employ depending on the type of fracture you are dealing with. There are many videos online that you can watch, including some on OrthoAccess, which I highly recommend you at least gloss over once, that will teach you how to splint a patient. Don't get too bogged down in the details about how many layers of plaster you need, or how many web rolls you need, or what sizes you need. The truth is that most places will have some small differences between them in terms of what they use. Some rotations will actually give you sheets telling you what specific supplies they want for their splints. But if you're at a place that didn't have a sheet like this, then just ask your resident what they want. Once you've asked them once, just have it written down somewhere so you don't have to ask them again. And then once you know the materials that you need for a specific type of splint, if you really want to show that you are someone that goes above and beyond, the next time you have a patient with the same type of fracture, go and get the splint materials ready before your resident even asks you to do so. In general, you should try to go get the splint materials if you know what you need before your resident asks. If you know how to prep the materials, a slightly more advanced move, if you've already done your first away and you are a little bit more comfortable and know what the splint looks like, you can actually start to open up the packaging and lay the materials out for them. What I mean by this is take the plaster, measure out the correct size, and layer it to the appropriate amount of layers. And then do the same with the web roll. Again, this is a little bit more advanced, so it's not the end of the world. At the very least, most of your residents will be grateful if you just go get the supplies ready and meet them in the room. Generally speaking, these supplies are going to include one or two buckets. And I'm talking about the gray buckets that most hospitals have. They're like a little rectangle. Cast padding slash web roll, a plaster, an ACE wrap, tape, Again, there's some small nuances to this depending on what location you're at. Some places don't like to use WebRoll, and some places don't like to use AceWrapps. Just talk to your resident and see what they like to use. I almost forgot one of the most important things. In one of the gray buckets, you're going to want to get hot water, and you're going to want it to be very hot. You don't want to get it right away necessarily because if your resident's not there and they take a while to come down, then the water's going to cool off. But you want to make sure that when you are ready to splint, you have hot water nearby. Hot water, it helps the splint harden a lot faster. If you use cold water, you're going to have to hold the reduction a lot longer. And once you've done one, maybe two or three, you are going to quickly realize why that is the worst thing in the world. One, if the patient is awake, they're going to be crying in pain and fighting you the whole way that you're trying to get your reduction. You're going to have to hold the reduction for a handful of minutes until the plaster hardens. And while it might seem like not that daunting of a task, depending on who the patient is, some limbs are heavier than others and can be a lot harder to hold up for that extended period of time. But there are some situations in which, granted, even if you are dealing with a limb that is relatively small, when you have to hold it for such a long length of time, it can become pretty daunting. I have one memory that sticks out very clearly to me about my on-call shifts. It was one of my first aways, and it was a very busy night, and we were reducing this patient's forearm fracture, and they weren't even a big patient, but it was a very difficult fracture to reduce, and so we were pulling and tugging on it for a very long length of time. And we were also wearing lead aprons because we had the mini C-arm in the room and we were taking some shots. And so by the time that the plaster had finally started to harden, my resident looks up at me and asks if I'm good, if we need to switch off or anything. And I just look back at him and we both start laughing because I'm completely soaked in sweat, like literally dripping past my eyes. So it definitely is a physically demanding job. And if you want to make your life easier, make sure you have hot water nearby for when you're going to splint someone. While on the subject of splinting, we should touch base again on the three key elements of a functional reduction, which, if you remember from the previous episode, are length, alignment, and rotation. We didn't talk too much in detail in the last episode about why these are important, so we'll do that now. Starting with length, it's important to restore the proper length of the bone, so that you don't have a fractured limb ending up short. You could easily picture how this would be an issue if you have a lower extremity injury. If the limb ends up being short afterwards, then that can cause all sorts of issues with gait, leading to pain in other regions like your back or causing pain in your other joints, and in some situations can even lead to a quicker development of arthritis. On the flip side, if a bone heals too long, that could also put stress on your surrounding muscles and tendons. So you want it to be just right. Next up, we have alignment. So you're going to want to put the fracture into a neutral alignment. You don't want to give your patients a new valgus or varus alignment that they never had before. That would cause similar issues to what we just talked about with your gait, arthritis, and pain. While some patients might have a natural varus or valgus alignment, you don't necessarily want to give that to a patient who's never had it before. And then last up, we have rotation. Rotation literally is referring to the bone twisting along its own axis. If a bone heals with a rotational deformity, it can really mess up how your limb functions, specifically in your forearm. If those bones heal with a twist, you will likely have a reduced pronation / supination range of motion. And so that's why all three elements are crucial for a good outcome. And it's why we have so many different tools and techniques that we can employ to ensure that we're getting the best outcome. On the subject of casts, some of the items that you're going to want to grab are, again, the gray buckets. You're going to grab a stocking net. You are going to need some cast padding / web roll. And then you'll need the fiberglass. Ask your resident first, but generally, most residents will be okay with using cold water for a cast because the little extra time that it'll take to harden is nice when you're doing a cast so that you can get the layers of the cast to properly laminate. One thing I forgot to mention is that in a small kidney basin or in another bucket, you should have some soap handy, and you want to get a generous amount, and I mean literal soap that you use to wash your hands, because once the layers of the casts have laminated, you will place soap on the outside of the cast to get rid of the sticky residue that is on it. One thing that you might be asked about is what the soap actually does to the cast, and that is that it stops the lamination process. So you don't necessarily want to throw the soap on there right away. As soon as you're done placing the cast, you want to give it a few seconds to allow the lamination process to continue and then put the soap on. You should also always know where the cast saw is kept so that if you are going to bivalve it or univalve the cast, or if you're going to be taking off a cast in the ED, you have it handy. Also, God forbid, you have to redo the cast because the reduction wasn't correct, then you'll also want to know where that saw is. And you most definitely do not want to be the med student that loses the cast saw. So keep it handy, know where it is, and make sure you put it back in its place. When molding casts or splints, it might appear that the reduction is a little bit exaggerated. And there is a saying that goes, straight casts lead to crooked bones, and crooked casts lead to straight bones. And what that means is that typically, you need to over-exaggerate your reduction in order to actually get a proper reduction. Continuing back on the conversation for when you're on call and you are going to see a consult who is going to need a splint, another thing you can prepare is the hematoma block. Now, this will depend a little bit on where you are, because at some places you might not have access to things like lidocaine, but if you are at a place where you do have access to it, then going ahead and getting the syringes and the needles, the alcohol swabs, and then getting everything ready is something else that you can do to be helpful when you're on call. Depending on the place you're at, for the actual hematoma block itself, some places might use just lidocaine, some places might mix lidocaine with bupivacaine. Ask your resident what they want and how much they want of it. And then feel free to start drawing that up if you already have it. You're gonna want to use a very small needle when you are actually injecting the hematoma block into the patient. Most likely, you'll use a 22 gauge needle since that's what they tend to have in the ED for the smallest. When you're drawing up the fluids, though, you'll want to use something a little bit bigger just to make it easier on yourself, like an 18 gauge. And you're probably wondering why it's called a hematoma block. And the reason for that is that it's a block, like a nerve block, right? That goes into the hematoma that's forming around the fracture site. That was always something that made me curious. I never really understood that at first because it doesn't necessarily block a hematoma from forming, which was what I thought initially. So now that we've kind of covered how you would handle a consult with a normal closed fracture, let's take a moment to talk about how you handle a consult or an open fracture. So open fractures are defined as communication of the bone with the external environment. They are often, but not always, the result of high energy trauma, and you do want to know that the most common location for open fractures are your fingers, with 50% of open fractures happening in fingers. This is typically because you'll see a lot of laceration injuries which result in open fractures, like when you have people using table saws, or if you have someone on 4th of July who is holding a firework for way too long. Other common areas include your tibia and your wrist. The most commonly used classification system for open fractures is the Gustilo and Anderson classification. You do want to have this one memorized. It's a very common PIMP question and it's not too complicated. So under the Gustilo-Anderson classification, type 1 open fractures are small, less than 1 centimeter in size. They are typically clean and from low energy. Type 2, they are moderate wounds with minimal soft tissue damage, and they are from low moderate energy. Type 3 is a severe skin wound with extensive soft tissue damage and are typically caused by high energy. An interesting PIMP question is, when do you actually determine what grade the fracture is? And the answer is that you actually determine it at the time of operative debridement. So when it's just in the ED, when it just came in, you can't actually definitively say what grade it is. So class 3 specifically is actually broken up into A, B, and C. And so type 3 has adequate soft tissue coverage, but it's a large high energy wound which may be grossly contaminated. The way you distinguish 3B from 3A is that you have extensive soft tissue loss and you actually need flap coverage. That is the defining feature of a 3B versus a 3A. And then the defining feature for a 3C versus a 3A is that there is an arterial injury requiring repair. So how bad is it to have a type 3 fracture? Well, if it's a type 3A fracture, 4% of patients will develop sepsis and 0% of patients will end up with an amputation. But if it's a type 3B fracture, then 52% of patients will develop sepsis, and the amputation rate jumps up to 16%. And then type 3C, 42% of patients will develop sepsis, and the amputation rate is around 42%. And then going back briefly to our last episode and our talk on compartment syndrome, remember that just because you have an open fracture does not rule out the possibility of compartment syndrome. And so 9.1% of compartment syndromes are actually in open fractures. So what should you do? So obviously, first up is the ATLS basics. You want to inspect and examine the limb. You're going to document the size of the wound, the location of the wound, and you want to make sure you take a good neurovascular exam. You're going to want to remove any accessible contaminants, irrigate it and dress it, do a wet to dry betadine soak, and then you'll want to reduce and splint it. After you reduce and splint it, you're going to want to repeat that neurovascular exam and document any changes. And very, very, very important, super high yield. You want to ensure that the patient is getting IV antibiotics and a tetanus booster. Super important to know is that early antibiotics decrease infection rates if given within 3 hours of injury. And then if there's any questions in regards to when the patient last had a booster, it's better to just err on the side of caution and give an additional booster. In regards to the antibiotics that you're going to use, you will typically use a first-generation cephalosporin like Ansev. And then if you need some gram-negative coverage, you can use an aminoglycoside or a third-generation cephalosporin. There is some controversy regarding whether or not you want to add penicillin if there is like contamination from dirt. If there is contamination from a lake or some standing water, then you might want to use a fourth generation cephalosporin. You want to get that extended gram positive coverage and also protect against maybe Pseudomonas. And then if there's bowel contamination, you'll want to add in metronidazole. When you have an open fracture, you must make sure that you have thoroughly cleaned up the wound before you place any definitive fixation. If there are doubts about whether or not the wound has been adequately cleaned, then a X-Fix can be used. Some open fractures may require multiple debridements prior to definitive fixation. However, that is not to say that you can't definitively fixate on the day of the first debridement if you feel that you've adequately cleaned the wound out. Not all your call shifts are going to be filled with fractures and fun consults. Generally speaking, you will have a fair share of not so interesting consults that will primarily consist of ruling out septic joints and seeing patients for potential abscesses. Depending on the night, that might be all that you see. So it's equally important to know the materials that you are going to need for seeing these consults as well. For an abscess, you're gonna need some chucks, you're gonna need a ChloraPrep sticks, sterile gloves, figure out where the laceration trays are, have a scalpel, some culture swabs, specimen cups, saline, packing strips, 4x4 gauze, and some Curlix Ready. If your resident shows up to the bedside and you have all those things already laid out on the table, they are going to be very happy with you. And then, in regards to pulling out a septic joint, some good knowledge for you to have is where you do the tap for each joint. This sometimes can correlate to where you would place steroids in that joint, also. It's good background knowledge to have, and it reinforces some of the anatomy that you are probably learning. It can help you get some practice kind of seeing where that anatomy actually is on a patient in regards to their bony landmarks. So for ruling out a septic joint, you'll want to get some chucks, some ChloraPreps, sterile gloves, an 18 gauge needle, and a couple of syringes, maybe 30 cc's, and then also you'll want some culture swabs. Well, guys, that's about all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining me on this journey into the world of orthopedics. I hope you found it useful. If you have any questions, feel free to email me or text me. Until next time, keep those bones strong and those brains even stronger.